I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jessica Sofer, the fine young author of the book, Tomorrow There'll Be Apricots. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This week we celebrate Israel's 65th birthday, and a major milestone it is. There's something wonderful about national birthdays, and ones that end in a 5 or a 0 are particularly notable. That's especially true for countries that haven't been around all that long, of course. I don't recall anybody throwing an especially big party for the 235th birthday of the United States, for example. So, still, it's a great day to celebrate Israel, to sing Israeli songs, do Israeli dances, eat falafel, and have a great time enjoying being Jewish in a world that has a vibrant, dynamic, creative, energetic, accomplished, democratic, innovative, free-speaking, beautiful, proud Jewish state that's a leader in so many areas of human endeavor. Go to our Israel festival here in Tucson or wherever you live, or at the very least, put on some old Israeli songs and kvel a little bit. But to play devil's advocate, maybe it's time to examine some of our powerful associations with Israel's birthday, Yom HaAtzmaut, as a marker of note. The question I have is, has Israel now matured past the stage when we have to marvel at every fifth-year birthday? Hasn't the Jewish state grown up enough that we have the luxury of taking some of these events for granted? Now, I'm not saying Israel qualifies for Social Security exactly, although it is 65, but it's no longer a young country. America, for example, turned 65 way back in 1841, but by that time we were a well-established nation. A slave nation, of course, but no longer a neophyte among countries. The truth is that while there are many American Jews who remember the miracle of Israel's founding, there are a lot of us who were born after that, well after that, and that's ultimately to the good. Actually, in the community of nations, whatever that phrase means, Israel isn't even really a newcomer at all. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union around 1990, there have been more than 20 new or revived nations founded out of its former territories, as well as a number of other countries created in areas from Africa to the South Pacific. In fact, just since Israel's 40th birthday in 1988, 29 new nations have been founded and admitted to the UN all around the world, including just 2 years ago, South Sudan. Israel is such an accomplished fact now, a leader in a variety of technology, medicine, education, agriculture, resettlement, and many other fields, that we really no longer need to marvel at its very existence, as we did for a long time. Israel's a great place to vacation, a fine place to live and work, an extraordinary country by every measure. This 65th anniversary is a birthday party for a nation that no longer faces national armies on its borders that are an actual threat to its existence. There remain challenges for Israel, as all nations have challenges, and some of Israel's are more intractable than most countries will ever have to face. But if we are to celebrate today, we need to celebrate the reality of a first-world successful nation, founded out of dreams and dirt by idealists and refugees who have built a great country, one that we can afford to enjoy and even take for granted from time to time without genuine fear for its viability. And so, to play us in on this fine morning, here's the classic Israeli song Atali Eretz, You Are My Country, written by Nurit Hirsch and Yoram Taharlev, sung by Yardena Arazi and popularized on the famous Israeli military radio show Arba Acharei HaTzoharayim, 4 in the afternoon. Ani posa'at cheresh bishvilecha Ani nogat beisvei hazman Ani lomedet et kol mishulecha
שכונה ליד קומה הים אני הולכת במסע אליך האדמה היא קשת וצרובה אני לאט פורחת בין סלעיך כמו איילה טועה בערבה אני יודעת עוד רבה הדרך אבל אלך בעד יכלה כוחי אתה לי ארץ עבודה לנצח אך שורשיך כבר בתוך תוכי תן לי זמן פושט לי יד עד נגלה ביחד את הארץ אני יודעת עוד רבה הדרך אך שורשיך כבר בתוך תוכי תן לי זמן פושט לי יד עד נגלה ביחד אני יודעת עוד רבה הדרך אך שורשיך כבר בתוך תוכי מוצאת בנסתרי החורש פינות בנלות ערכה עוד אהבה ובצילן אפול מוקץ חרחורת וזאת הארץ הטובה אני יודעת עד ימי איתנו לא לא עבוד עם קי לבך אך מה יפה הדרך בה השארתי את פסיעותיי שלי על אדמתך יודעת עוד רבה הדרך אבל אלך בעד יכלה כוחי אתה לי ארץ עבודה לנצח אך שורשיך כבר בתוך תוכי תן לי זמן פושט לי יד עד נגלה ביחד את הארץ אני יודעת עוד רבה הדרך אך שורשיך כבר בתוך תוכי זמן פושט לי יד עד נגלה ביחד את הארץ אני יודעת עוד רבה הדרך אך שורשיך כבר בתוך תוכי
That was Atali Eretz, You Are My Land, a song of Israel for its birthday this week. The lyrics are actually a beautiful poem. I know the road is still long, but I will walk it until I have no strength. I know that until I die I will not reach the depths of your heart, but how beautiful is your path, the path where I left my steps on your land. You know, since we're celebrating Israel's 65th birthday on Two Jewish Today, I was thinking about past Yom HaAtzma'ut celebrations from many years ago. I particularly remember when we celebrated Israel's 25th birthday way back in 1973. It was a time of enormous pride and confidence. 6 years after the Six-Day War reinvented our tiny Jewish state into a regional power, when everybody looked at Israel as a startling success story in a period of deep national and international tsoras, the time of Vietnam and Cambodia and Watergate. There was a stunning optimism to that 25th birthday celebration of Israel, great pride in Israel's amazing accomplishments militarily, its moral stature as the only sane democracy in a region of Arab, megalomaniac, medieval craziness. Its woman prime minister, Golda Meir, was a star. She seemed like everyone's very wise, very tough bubby. And the one-eyed military hero, Moshe Dayan, its young, muscular Sabra men and the gorgeous, strong women soldiers, the great Israeli music that seemed to come out every week, even the Israeli folk dances everybody was doing. I was 12. I thought they were lame. But still, there was a great romance to Israel back then. Not just the fantastic biblical history, but the dynamic new country that had been and was being created daily. Little did we know that just a few months later, the Yom Kippur War would threaten Israel's existence, followed by the first Arab oil embargo, economic meltdown, and non-stop Palestinian-Arab terrorism. The truth is that today's Israel is so much more advanced than the Israel of 40 years ago. It's a better place in nearly every way, more beautiful, more developed, far better food, more civilized, kinder, more accomplished, more grown up. So if something is lost in that transition from the romance of the idealistic time, there is still much more that is gained. Mazel tov to Israel on its 65th birthday this week. May she continue to grow from strength to strength and move always towards peace. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, we'll meet our guest, the fine young author Jessica Sofer, whose new novel is called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. It explores family and love and identity and delicious food and Iraqi Jews. All that when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help make quality Jewish education available to local students in need of financial support by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO. Here's how it works. Arizona allows taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized organizations like JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to children who attend local Jewish schools in Tucson. These tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you make a contribution to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit, which means that your Arizona state income tax is reduced or your refund is increased up to the amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. You have until April 15th to make your contribution for the 2012 tax year. To foster Jewish education today, give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. Or go online to JETCO.org. By making a tax credit contribution to JETCO, you help nurture Jewish identity in Tucson for new generations of students like me. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning our guest, Jessica Sofer. Her new book is called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, and it will actually come out this Tuesday, just coming out this week, her first novel. And it is a delightful and delicious book, I have to say, in which, well, family, relationships, food, Iraqi Jews, all kinds of interesting ideas come in. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So, my first thought about the book, having started to read it and getting into it and then reading the recipes, is how do you write this book and not constantly rush off to the kitchen to cook or eat?
I found early on that the more I eat in the process of writing, the more sluggish I feel, and somehow it seems like the narrative follows suit. So I tend to not eat while writing, but I do often cook while I'm writing.
The premise of the book, I mean, it's a very interesting way you sort of work into it, but talk a little bit about how you ended up writing so much about the Iraqi Jewish community.
My father was an Iraqi Jew. He came to the U.S. roughly around the same time that the two characters who are Iraqi Jewish in the novel come to the U.S., which is in the late 1940s and the early 1950s. And it's a fascinating culture and one that isn't too terribly focused on in literature. There's a lot of sort of political documentary on that political group, but not very much in literature. And so I wanted to focus on it, though that wasn't really the drive for my writing of the novel. And I did a lot of research and spoke to a lot of family members, and that's how it came about.
You know, this is a little bit off of your exact track, but I had the good fortune in rabbinical school to be in a very small reading class in which we were reading Samuel Michael and some other sort of Iraqi-influenced or Iraqi Jews who were writing in Israel, writing about that experience. So much, you know, the Iraqi community goes back 3,000 years, probably, maybe to First Temple times. And yet it's really essentially an immigrant community. There's almost no Jews left in Iraq now. Did your dad's sort of, I don't know how to describe it, pining or his kind of relocation experience influence the development of the book at all?
Yeah, and in a particular way, I think. As you said, Samuel Michael was in Israel, and there was a very sort of fiercely political and very vocal community that grew there after the Jews fled Baghdad, fled Iraq. And the majority of them went to Israel, something like 120,000 out of 135,000 Jews left between 1948 and 1951, and most of them were airlifted to Israel. But my father took the road sort of less traveled by going through Iran very illegally, and then eventually came to Ellis Island. So he didn't have the same kind of community that the Jews, the Iraqi Jews in Israel did, but he built his own community in the U.S.
We will talk much more, not just about Iraqi Jews, but about her fascinating and delicious book. Tomorrow there will be Apricots with author Jessica Sofer, and we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows, streaming them from the website. Again, that's toojewishradio.com. Or download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. In celebrating Yom HaAtzmaut this week, we must note that Israel's culture is a dynamic, evolving one, and social commentary is a critical part of popular and higher culture there. We continue with a challenging Israeli song from Muki called Kulam Medabrim Al Shalom. Everybody talks about peace, but nobody talks about justice.
כולם מדברים על שלום, אף אחד לא מדבר על צדק. לאחד זה גן עדן, לאחר גיהנום. כמה אצבעות על ההדק. עד מתי יהום השר? עד מתי אדם בן כלב? מחליקות הפנים על התער, מלטפות אצבעות את החרב. יאו! לפעמים החיים מורידים אותי על הברכיים. אין שומר את השאר, אין סימן משמיים. רואה אנשים שחיים חלומות ותקוות, אנשים שחיים רק תככים ומזימות.
יש ששואלים שאלות ואין תשובות יש כאלה מלאים רק טענות ודרישות אבל כולם מדברים על שלום אף אחד לא מדבר על צדק לאחד זה גן עדן לאחר גהנום כמה אצבעות על ההדק כולם מדברים על שלום אף אחד לא מדבר על צדק לאחד זה גן עדן לאחר גהנום כמה אצבעות על ההדק אז נשארים לבד מדברים אל הקיר אין עם מי לדבר אם רק נבין שכולנו אחד נראה הכל מתחבר שישרף רכושך תישרף נשמתך אם לא תמהר להציל את עצמך רצחנו אדמה ורצחנו נשמה כמעט ולא נשאר לנו אוויר לנשימה והעולם בתנועה מתמדת עושה סיבוב וחוזר אל אותה נקודה מה שעולה חייב לרדת איך לוקחים את הכל במידה כי כולם מדברים על שלום אף אחד לא מדבר על צדק לאחד זה גן עדן לאחר
That was Israeli star Mookie singing Everybody Talks of Peace, Kulam Medabrim al Shalom. The words are, everybody has the same dream. Over the mountain, across the valley, they continue to talk about peace. But there will be no peace without justice. We welcome Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, our maven on Israel. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, last week we had a very important, serious commemoration, Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Tonight we remember, and tomorrow, Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day, Israeli Remembrance Day of those who died in the wars. Talk about what that means. You know, this is not a familiar festival for most American Jews.
Yes, we will meet tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the JCC for this free and open commemoration of Yom HaZikaron, Israel Memorial Day. You know, to some degree, many of us celebrate the existence of Israel, and next week when we'll have the big Israel festival, we will come and have fun together and celebrate and you know, do a lot of fun stuff.
65th birthday of Israel, big one.
True. But, you know, we need to remember, this didn't come out of thin air. It came with a very heavy price, and the price was not a price of money. It was a price of blood. About 30,000 Israelis have paid with their lives so that Israel can exist. Israel is still in constant conflict and wars with its neighbors. Protecting Israel and protecting Jewish people worldwide is very, very challenging. And at that day, for an hour, we come together as a community to pay our respect, to say we care, to say it is important to us.
I don't think, you know, while Americans may still go to Memorial Day commemorations, particularly veterans and their families, I think for Americans, the immense, the deeply networked Israeli society, the number of people who know somebody who died, the next door neighbor's kid died, the father died, you know, this is a very common experience. It's a small country, still Israel. And Yom HaZikaron demonstrates it as much as anything.
You know, for me, it's extremely personal. I've personally lost some of my best friends. My wife have lost her uncle during the Yom Kippur War. I was there when some of the people I cared about died during military service. So it is something very deep, very emotional, very, very painful. And it gives a lot of power to see Americans, Jews and non-Jews, coming to this commemoration, showing respect, sharing the pain, sending a message to us Israelis that you care.
And that we owe a debt as American Jews to those Israeli Jews who have died protecting Israel and keeping it free. Guy, thanks. I don't know, what do we say? May their memory be a blessing. Zecher Tzadik Livracha.
May it be. Yisgol.
We will talk next week. When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So there's a very interesting exhibit at a famous museum in Berlin, which is, of course, controversial.
Right. So it's the Jewish Museum in Berlin that we've talked about before. And I must admit, for the sake of total transparency, that I did not read this article. I heard about it. But I am reliably informed that there was an article in the New York Times reporting on what is an extremely controversial, but I don't quite understand why, exhibit in the museum where there is a Jewish person sitting in sort of a transparent plastic cube in a comfortable chair, and visitors, who in most cases are non-Jewish Germans going to learn about the country's Jewish past, are encouraged to sit in the other chair opposite the Jew in the cage. And
the man in the glass.
Right, exactly. And ask questions, whatever, because most Germans today, especially if they're under 75, have never met a living Jew. So it's their first opportunity to ask a Jew, like, what makes you different? How do you feel as a German? Why do you live in Germany? Whatever it is, like, what makes a Jew a Jew? They ask all kinds of fascinating basic questions, and obviously the Jewish person sitting in the exhibit eventually gets tired, so there's like four people a day who do this for an hour or two at a time, and they get spelled by each other. And as an educator, I think it's a great idea. Nobody's being forced to do this. Nobody's being forced to answer questions or to ask them. But to have someone available to answer these questions in a country that doesn't have a radio show like this one, where people could presumably call in and ask questions or email you with their questions and you would address those questions, there is no such mechanism in Germany. So this is actually a great, I think, educational opportunity for the German public to increase its knowledge of Jewish traditions and the Jewish present and the Jewish history in Germany. And it is clear every time I visit that museum that the vast, vast majority of visitors are non-Jewish Germans who are trying to acquaint themselves with an important part of their country's past, also present, and hopefully future.
You know, it's fascinating. I suppose almost anything Jewish having to do with Germany is going to be controversial by its nature, with the Shoah past, with the Holocaust, even though, you know, the Jewish history in Germany goes back 1,000 years and more, perhaps. But what an interesting kind of way of just doing what we would call ask the rabbi, but it's just ask a normal Jew.
Right. Exactly. And I think actually that the Jewish history in Germany goes back at least to Roman times. I mean, when Trier
originally
was the capital,
yeah,
of a quarter of the Roman Empire, you can be sure that there was a Jewish community there. And the Jewish community in Cologne definitely predates the First Crusade, which was 1,000 years ago. So, I mean, I don't know which Jewish communities in Germany date from which times, but I know that there are communities that are probably even 2,000 years old. Whether they're continuous communities or not is another question.
Right. Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe is on vacation in Israel with his wife, children, and mother-in-law. Sadly, while they're in Jerusalem, Abe's mother-in-law dies. Abe goes to the U.S. consulate to make arrangements to send her body back home for burial. As soon as the official realized that it's Abe's mother-in-law who's died, he tells him it's very expensive to send a body back to the U.S. Could cost you $10,000, he says, in most cases. The family decides to bury the body here in Israel. It only costs $500. But Abe gets very agitated. I don't care how much it costs to send her body back to the U.S. That's what we're going to do, okay? Okay, says the official. Calm down. We'll do it. You must have really loved your mother-in-law a lot, considering the price difference. No, that's not the reason, says Abe. It's just that I heard of a case, somebody buried here in Jerusalem many, many years ago, and he arose from the dead on the third day. I don't want to take that chance. That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature to Jewish just for you and not for your mother-in-law. You should live and be well. Her too. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Achrimot and Kedoshim. They include the Code of Holiness, a description of the ethical injunctions that lie at the heart of Jewish practice. The code itself has mitzvot that require us to assist the poor, treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness, and insists on fair business practices. They obligate us to live moral lives. It's important that this remarkable holiness section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kedoshim, this holiness code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. That is, it forms the heart of the heart of our most sacred text. And at that heart is the ethical injunction, Ve'ahavt l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is an amazing and perhaps utopian ideal, to love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. If our society was actually rooted in such a conception, how much different it would be, how much better. But in true Jewish fashion, this is not simply allowed to remain an idealistic statement. It is instead made into a practical imperative. Achrimot Kedoshim builds up to this magnificent religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and the orphan. Be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical, because that is at the heart of real holiness. The way to love your neighbor is by treating him or her fairly and honestly. It is that notion of the pragmatic approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert our neighbors to our own views. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own beliefs. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of ourselves. Rather, we are commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated, respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, even generously. That is love of one's neighbor, expressed in a functional, healthy society. May we learn that lesson. When we come back on Too Jewish, our wonderful guest, Jessica Sofer, the author of Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, will explain how Iraqi Jews and food and identity all come together. Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu, aleinu,
Natan Sharansky has been a hero for worldwide Jewry for many, many years. From his courageous days standing as the most prominent prisoner of Zion, called Anatole, then Anatoly Sharansky, during the dark days of the Soviet Union, on to his career in Israel, advocating for the new Soviet immigrants, and then for his principled and intelligent leadership of the Jewish Agency. He has always reached out to Jews of every flavor. We may now have another reason to honor Natan Sharansky. He seems to have come up with a visionary plan for the holiest Jewish site in the world, the Kotel, the Western Wall in Jerusalem, which will unite all Jews of every denomination at that most sacred place. In Sharansky's words, it will be one Western Wall for one Jewish people. Sharansky was appointed by Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to find a solution to the exclusion of egalitarian prayer from the Kotel and the recent demonization and arrest of the women of the wall by the police following the orders of the Orthodox rabbinic authorities at the Kotel. Sharansky's plan, revealed last week at a meeting with North American Jewish leaders, was a dramatic offer to set up a new egalitarian prayer section at the Kotel in Jerusalem. It was met with a similarly dramatic willingness to compromise on behalf of all the major religious leaders in the American Jewish community. In a rare show of consensus, activists on the liberal side of the reform movement agreed to drop their demand for egalitarian prayer in all parts of the wall, the last remnant of the ancient Jewish temple and the holiest place for Jews worldwide. On the other end of the religious spectrum, Orthodox groups agreed not to try to derail the plan that would allow, for the first time in the history of the modern state of Israel, men and women to pray together in one section of the Kotel area. Even Anat Hoffman, a past guest of Two Jewish and leader of the Women of the Wall, the activist who insists on the right of women to wear tallises, talitot, and read Torah in the women's only section, and have often been arrested for trying to do so, especially lately, even Anat Hoffman supports this compromise plan. Sharansky wrote the proposal after a couple of months of shuttle diplomacy among communal leaders. "This is the first step in our journey. We hope it will lead to a resolution that will create a stronger unity," said Jerry Silverman, president and CEO of the Jewish Federations of North America. Silverman called the consensus emerging around Sharansky's plan significant, adding that it requires a show of flexibility on behalf of all sides. "I don't know that everyone will ever be satisfied with every issue," he said. Well, of course not, but it's a great start. The road to resolving the issue of women's prayer at the Kotel, the Western Wall, may still be bumpy. There are many potential pitfalls awaiting Sharansky as he moves ahead, redefining the physical contours of a place that's at the heart of Jewish history and really religious life today. But after getting the green light from American Jews, Sharansky will now have to overcome political resistance in Israel, a number of technical, archaeological, budgetary, legal, even geopolitical problems that could even derail the plan. Sharansky considered redesigning the Kotel Plaza and dividing it into equally sized Orthodox and egalitarian areas shortly after he was given the job by Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu 3 months ago. His job was to find a solution to the escalating dispute with diaspora Jewry over women's rights to pray at the wall. Monthly arrests and detentions of members of Women of the Wall have drawn increasing attention in the U.S. and here on Too Jewish, and were frequently referenced by Jewish leaders whenever they met with Israeli officials. In February, Sharansky met in Jerusalem with a group of rabbis from the Jewish Federation of North America's rabbinical cabinet. I'm a member of that, offer full disclosure, and presented them with his thoughts about expanding the prayer area along the wall. He followed up with a series of meetings and phone calls with leaders of the reforming conservative denominations in the U.S. and discussed the idea with Israeli lawmakers and religious leaders, too. Those talks resulted in a plan presented by Sharansky to the rabbinical cabinet in a meeting in New York last week. It calls for building a new entryway to the Kotel area. It will present visitors with a choice. They can go to the left, to the designated Orthodox area, or turn right to the egalitarian section. The whole plaza will be expanded and will reach the area known as Robinson's Arch, currently just below the Kotel Plaza, but actually a continuation of that same historic wall. The Orthodox part of the wall will remain exactly as it is now. It will have a divider separating men and women and will continue to be governed by the Orthodox rabbinate through the Western Wall Heritage Foundation. The egalitarian area will allow members of all denominations to pray freely and will allow for family events like bar and bat mitzvah ceremonies and weddings. The governance structure for this part is still being discussed, but Sharansky suggested the Jewish agency and the non-Orthodox denominations would jointly oversee the operation. In a statement issued following his presentation of the plan, Sharansky said the Kotel will once again be a symbol of unity among the Jewish people, not one of discord and strife. It sounds, so far, like a magnificent solution for all parties. May God give strength, wisdom, and perseverance to Natan Sharansky. He has all three, but perhaps he needs a little greater measure here, and allow this excellent plan to proceed smoothly and speedily, b'mehera v'yomenu, in our time. In smaller but significant news, just before Pesach last month, the Rabbinical Council of California discovered that Mike Engelman, the owner of Doheny Glot Kosher Meats, had smuggled uncertified meat into his store. Engelman, who ran the finest kosher meat market in L.A. and had an excellent reputation, was caught on videotape by a Jewish private detective receiving unidentified meat into his own personal SUV, loading it into his store when the mashgiach, the rabbinical supervisor, was absent, major violations of the oversight required for kosher production. After immediately suspending Doheny Market's kashrut certification, the Rabbinical Council of California had to decide if all the meat from that location was therefore unkosher, ruining the Passover seders of lots of Angelinos. It was obvious to all of us we needed an unbiased decision from an expert outside the community, Rabbi Avraham Union, the rabbinic administrator of the RCC, said, and so they called on Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, a well-respected arbiter of halacha in Brooklyn, about as far as you can get in America from L.A. If Belsky determined that all the meat was tainted, observant Southern Californians might have been forced to toss out all the food they prepared for Passover. People would have been served salad on Passover night for Seder, said Rabbi Meyer May, the RCC president. Not to mention, what would they have eaten the rest of the week? Anyway, after weighing the information, Belsky ruled that all meat sold prior to March 24th, the day the news of the alleged transgressions came to light, was kosher, even though a small portion was not properly certified. Belsky saved Passover. Kosher violations like this are rare but not unheard of. News emerges occasionally that a trusted kosher market or vendor has sold clients food products, either intentionally or unintentionally, that did not comply with the dietary stipulations of Jewish law. Doheny Kosher Market has now been sold to another owner with impeccable Orthodox credentials and will be reopened with new management and enhanced rabbinical supervision. But Rabbi May cautioned that errors can occur even with the best practices in place. Greed exists in the world. You always have the potential for it, and anyone can circumvent the system and make a little bit more money, he said. The system was good. It exceeded the national standard, but we had a human failure. Happens like that sometimes. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Jessica Sofer. Her first novel is called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, and it won't come out tomorrow, but it'll come out the day after tomorrow. This Tuesday it'll be released. It's a beautiful book, by the way, filled with a really interesting and challenging story, well-written, with a lot of delicious recipes that connect both food and relationships and, I guess, the development of family, real and created. I don't know the right way to describe it. Can you talk a little bit about how you came into the story itself?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for all those beautiful things you just said about the book. It started with a short story that I wrote while I was in graduate school getting my MFA at Hunter. It was a story about a girl whose name was Lorca, who ends up being the character in Apricots. And she's a self-harmer, a pain addict, which is also what happens when she is in Apricots. And she, it's this sort of very staccato recounting of a woman's life of self-harm from the time she's very young to the time that she's an adult. And I just found her voice compelling and her certain method of coping in the world very fascinating. Pain addiction is rampant, and I was never a self-harmer, but I knew people that were. And I just found her particular way of surviving to be compelling and one that I wanted to return to when I wanted to write something greater. And soon after I decided I wanted to write something larger and take her with me, I sort of stumbled upon this image of two people cooking in a kitchen, a young person and an old person. It felt appropriate that Lorca be the young person. And I always knew I wanted to write about my father's culture, the Iraqi Jewish culture, and so it felt appropriate that the old person be an Iraqi Jew, because the majority of sort of full-blood Iraqi Jews are older, or if not gone. So it sort of came from that, and the food came in because that's kind of how I access my heritage, both my Jewish heritage and my particularly Iraqi Jewish heritage. It's the way I kind of understand it and associate to it.
You know, food is so important to so many Jewish cultures. The title comes from an Arabic phrase. Can you share the background of it?
Yeah, the Arabic phrase, and I don't speak Arabic, but it's Bukra Fil Mishmish, tomorrow there will be apricots, and it sort of means a couple of things. People have different understandings of what it means depending on where they are in the Middle East. But it means that there will be good days tomorrow, but also that... don't put off tomorrow what you can do today. The apricot season is a very short and fickle one. Sometimes there isn't even an apricot season. And so it really sort of means seize the day. But also, it's as much happy as it is dark, which I think is sort of a reflection of the book. There is a lot of kind of hopefully heartwarming feelings in the book, but equally so, real pain and tragedy.
In dealing with this really challenging issue of... well, it's not just cutting of self-harming that you mention, in which Lorca's first experience of that is actually reaching to take a tray that's too hot, burning herself, and discovering in some weird way that she likes it. Talk a little bit about exploring that, because if this isn't your own personal experience, a very challenging experience, some of us who work as rabbis, you know, encounter this in our own congregations.
It's an addiction, and it can start very young, probably younger than a lot of addictions, and the interesting part about it is that I went to a number of cutters meetings, and listening to people describe their particular experience feels very much a method of escape as much as a way of sort of inhabiting the world more, really feeling one's emotions, feeling the sort of weight of things that doesn't feel accessible otherwise. And so it doesn't feel like such an irrational way of dealing with the world. It just feels like a really, really sad one.
On a happier, or at least more complicated note, where did you get the cooking skills, the recipe orientation? Was it from your dad? Was it from other relatives?
Some of it was from my father's sister, who came to the U.S. years after my father, after living in Israel for many years. And growing up, many of my most... important food memories come from her house on Long Island, where we went for High Holy Days, and she would be sort of stewing these orange concoctions, and really she was a beautiful cook, and those were sort of those are the flavors of my childhood, I guess, in a lot of ways. And other than that, I have always loved to cook. I've always loved to eat. I grew up with parents who put a great emphasis on eating healthily, and so I just always considered food in a very kind of conscientious way. I was just very conscious of it and what it can do for a person. My father's mother was a healer in Baghdad and believed in sort of eating for one's well-being. The Iraqi Jews often ate by color. They never ate anything black. They peeled an eggplant because it was considered unlucky. They would eat brightly colored foods to encourage happiness, to encourage luck, things like that. But that all came through research.
That focus on food as it's more than recipes. You know, it sounds like a lovely story. It is a lovely story. Well, not a lovely story. It's a great story. But the food takes on a kind of a different valence. I don't know how to describe it exactly. Probably you're better at it than I am. It's woven all through. But tell us, sort of, I don't know, what's your relationship in this book to it?
That's a really good question. I've been thinking about that a lot lately. I think that there are a lot of really beautiful books about food out there, and food is so, it lends itself to kind of sensual, nostalgic descriptions. And I did that. I felt like that was an important way to talk about food. But equally so, there's a certain real sadness that can be accessed through the discussion of food. For example, Victoria, who's the Iraqi Jewish narrator, she talks about maskouf. It's sort of the main dish of the book. It's this grilled fish that was often eaten on the Tigris and the Euphrates. The fish was caught and whisked out of the waters and grilled right there with lemons, and typically it was carp. And the thing that's really sad about that is that fish will never be eaten that particular way again. That dish can never really be replicated. There were dead bodies in those rivers, and there was a fatwa declared on those fish, and so no one will ever eat that way again. And so as much as food can sort of bring people together, it can also really be a kind of a soreness that stays with a person for years and years.
That it's not really just nostalgia, it's a loss.
Of course.
Loss. This is your first novel.
It is.
Always a challenge, and particularly a challenge to carry it through to the end. It's hard to end a novel. It seems to me that there's a lot of great books out there that never quite figure it out. In fact, you can probably win a major award without still having figured out how to write the end of your novel. Was that hard for you?
I was fortunate enough to start with the ending, actually, which doesn't mean that any part of the process was easy or that it turned out the way I would have wished or in a way that I'm wholly proud of. But I tend to write from images. I kind of morph ideas into an image, and that's the way I can put them into words. And I started with this image of these two women cooking together in a kitchen. And so I kind of just worked towards that image, continually trying to justify it and make it seem appropriate in the end. So that was the driving force. The end was really the driving force. The part that was kind of murky and difficult was the inside of the book, trying to make all the pieces fit so that when we got to that final image, it felt right.
All right, so what's your favorite recipe?
That's a good question. I would say probably maskouf, only because it seems like the sort of saddest recipe in the book, also the one that really, really is the magnet bringing people together, but also the one that really can't be replicated exactly as it was. And I think that that sense of loss, as you say, is exactly the point. The point that I was trying to make, and the point that I think so many people sort of have to struggle with, that memories are what they are, and you can only access them in a way that adapts them.
You know, I also wanted to mention, you know, many people, I don't know, some of us have had kubeh, but I don't think too many of us have had bamia. Is that pronounced correctly?
Bamia. Mm-hmm.
Bamia. It sounds fantastic also.
It is. Okra's tricky. Years after I had my aunt's bamia, I had okra in a different form and was just completely thrown by the taste and texture of it. I had no idea that's what it was.
Can
but
be
bamia
horrifying,
lends it,
yes.
Okra sort of lends itself to bamia. It's acidic enough that it doesn't really get that kind of slimy texture that people are turned off by.
Right.
So that is a good way to cook okra, but just don't stir it too much. That tends to encourage the juices.
See, you know, what you can learn on the Two Jewish Radio Show. Jessica Sofer has a wonderful book. It's called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. It's out this week, available, of course, on Amazon and everywhere else. And she will personally cook these recipes for you if you buy the book, correct?
That's will, I promise.
Oh, you know, you never want to promise something on the air. Jessica, thank you for a wonderful visit on Two Jewish and great success with the book.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Wayne Dossick, a teacher, preacher, author, healer, and very interesting spiritual figure indeed. Our playoff this morning comes in celebration of Israel's 65th birthday, Yom HaAtzmaut, which falls this week on April 16th. It's a classic Israeli song from Arik Einstein and Miki Gavrielov, Uf Gazal, about a chick flying out from the nest. You know, kids growing up. And maybe in the case of Israel, countries growing up too. My friends, may you be blessed with a Chag HaAtzmaut Sameach, a fabulous 65th birthday celebration of Israel, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
ואני ציפור סגנה נשארתי בקן מקווה מאוד שהכל יהיה בסדר תמיד ידעתי שיבוא היום שבו צריך להיפרד אבל עכשיו זה ככה בא לי פתאום אז מה הפלא שאני קצת דואג אוף גוזל חתוך את השמיים